The Vatican is making headlines this week with a new document on human dignity, addressing everything from gender ideology to abortion. But what isn't being said? The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, are here with analysis. And Academy Award-nominated actor and philanthropist Gary Sinise joins me for a moving, exclusive interview about his son Max's valiant cancer battle and the lesson he left them, and Max's final musical project, Resurrection and Revival. An important world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. Lots to cover tonight. And that very moving story of Max Sinise, as told by his father, Gary Sinise, coming up. You don't want to miss that. It was just such a heartwarming and inspiring piece that I want to share with you. The Vatican released yet another directive this week, and it's caused some controversy. Dignitas Infinita, or Infinite Dignity, a 20-page document released on April 8th, deals with hot-button social issues, including gender theory and abortion, surrogacy and euthanasia, and appears to affirm established Catholic doctrine. But concerns are being raised. Joining me with analysis is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, who joins us from Rome, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. We must say Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, the Vatican's doctrinal chief, he previewed this document months ago following the backlash over the blessings of same-sex couples. He said in January, quote, "I don't think I will be in the news in the future because we do not have any issues planned that could be very controversial, like the last ones." And then he said the dicastery would be producing this document on human dignity, suggesting that it would somehow placate conservatives with strong affirmations of church teaching. Infinite dignity has been in the works for 5 years, we are discovering. Father, the cardinal setup here, it has the ring of a political horse trading operation about it. You know, that, okay, I know we offended you over here, and I know there's a lot of controversy in Africa, and all these countries have gone sideways, but you'll really like this document. Your take on this and the setup, the way that this was framed coming out.
Yes, I think that's accurate in the analysis of what Cardinal Fernandez said in the past. The question is, does this document solve all issues and calm all fears? And my answer is no. There are a lot of good things in the document. I know we'll look at those individual elements. But to set up a church teaching as somehow countering the concerns over an earlier teaching, such as fiducia, and then let's go back to the permission for transsexual godparents. You remember that document. So this new document does pose some real challenges to what they issued in the past. And but to say everything's fine, we can keep going, well, no, we have to look at each document, analyze it, contrast and compare with previous magisterial teaching.
Bob, you have been in Rome all week. This document does have an obligatory air about it. What's the reaction in Rome?
Well, look, generally speaking, I think people are relieved that it isn't worse than it is. As Father said, there's lots that's very good. The first half of it is a ringing affirmation of a lot of basic Catholic truths about morals and about social teaching. But I think you were onto something, Raymond, when you said that it was sort of a setup, because at the press conference that Cardinal Fernandez gave when the document was issued on Monday, he first of all pointed out that the title, Infinite Dignity, is from a speech of John Paul's, Pope John Paul II, St. John Paul II, in 1990. And then he went on, and he actually said again at the press conference, that the document was actually officially published on April 2nd, which was the 19th anniversary of John Paul II's death. So they very clearly wanted to make it obvious that this document was pegged to prior church teaching, a very popular pope, recent pope, John Paul II. My worry about this is the words are okay, but what we've seen over the past years in Rome are that while the teaching is not formally changed in most cases, that we see things like the John Paul II Institute on Marriage and the Family being denatured, that many things happening that are directly contrary to what John Paul II put in motion. So we can say that at least the first half of the document, I think, is pretty much a reflection of good, solid Catholic teaching. But whether those words will be actually carried out in practice remains to be seen.
Yeah, well, let's get into the marrow of this document, infinite dignity. And here is how it's defined in the document, infinite dignity. It says every human person possesses an infinite dignity inalienably grounded in his or her very being, which prevails in and beyond every circumstance, state, and situation the person may ever encounter. This principle, which is fully recognizable even by reason alone, underlies the primacy of the human person and the protection of human rights. Now, Father, some critics have pointed out that infinite dignity, that term, is usually only ascribed to Jesus Christ. But here it's being applied to human rights. Is that appropriate?
I think it's a mistake because finite creatures cannot possess infinite dignity. We are all finite. We share in God's grace, and therefore we have a share in God's infinite dignity, but we're not infinitely having dignity in and of ourselves. And then secondly, the problem with that definition is it doesn't refer to creation. The reason we have dignity as human beings is we were created in the image and likeness of God. So that dignity that we ascribe to humanity is a particular gift of God. Now, you can discover from reason that God exists, but the attributes of God's revelation open our eyes to see in what consists the proper use of the created reality that man is so that he doesn't offend that dignity. And that's where problems happen because people don't agree on what's the proper relationship between individual dignity and choices that we make.
Well, and the document does state that Christ elevates human dignity. But does he elevate it up to his own status? I guess that's the question here. And without the prerequisite of buying into Christ, buying into all of the prerequisites that he lays down throughout his ministry and of course, in the gospel, does one have access to that infinite dignity that's implied here, Father?
That's right. It's really a poetic use of the word infinite because nothing that we do is infinite. It's limited. We started in a certain period of time. Everything before us has a history. We weren't part of that. So, yeah, the claim that we have infinite dignity is poetic, but it's not theological or philosophical.
Mm. Bob, American journalist Diane Montagna asked Cardinal Fernandez at the Monday press conference, if man has infinite dignity, how can he be condemned to hell? Fernandez responded this way. He said, the human being can choose and that God wills to respect that freedom, even if it is a limited freedom. But then the question that Pope Francis asks is, with all the limits that our freedom truly has, might it not be that hell is empty? Bob, your thoughts on Cardinal Tuccio's remarks there and how he ties in amusing a question by the Pope as an answer.
Yeah, that was a very clever question for Diane Montagna to put forward. And look, he kind of got it right. He said that God respects our liberty enough that he allows it the possibility that we can choose actually to go to hell, but that we can hope, as Francis has repeatedly said, that hell is empty. The problem, it seems to me, with this infinite, to use the term infinite, some philosophers say it means limitless. It doesn't mean that we are on the same plane with God. There is an Eastern theological tradition that says God becomes man so that we can become godlike. And I think when that is the meaning of what's being said, then it's fine. But I think that the way that that term was used by John Paul II, I would have a lot more confidence in than the ways that we see it being said, for example, that transitioning people to a different sex or people who are practicing same-sex acts still have their dignity, fine, but they're also kind of being half welcomed into the understanding of the church. And I think that's where there's a confusion between the absolute gift that of love and freedom that God gives us and the way that people are being treated now in the church as opposed to how we regarded them in the past.
Father Jerry Montagna followed up by asking why original sin and its effects are never mentioned in this infinite dignity document. And Cardinal Fernandez simply replied that not even original sin removes this dignity. Your reaction to that?
It doesn't remove the dignity of being created by God, but it offends that dignity. And in fact, it's because of that, because of original sin and then all the personal sins committed as a result of that since that time, that Jesus Christ became man. There's a confusion when you use the word dignity between the ontological, metaphysical characteristic of being a creature formed and created in the image and likeness of God, and then dignity as a reflection of the level of honor that we should give to each human being. Because, saints have a higher dignity, morally speaking, and in terms of sanctity, than do, the most abject sinners. Now, in God's grace, we can go from sinner to saint if we apply ourselves and are faithful to the Lord. But, the real question here is it an offense against dignity for man to be punished, whether it be on this earth or in the world to come? And the Catholic teaching is always clear. Punishment is an affirmation of human dignity because it's calling one to be responsible for one's behavior, to admit when one's done wrong. And then in the next life, when the time of merit is over, the final judgment made by God cannot be an offense against human dignity. People who are damned are there because of their own fault, not because of God's mistake. So for damnation to exist, of course it doesn't offend human dignity. It affirms the fact that as free creatures, we can make bad decisions.
To its credit, the document does uphold the Church's condemnation of gender theory, surrogacy, abortion as affronts to human dignity. Father, given the document's stance on all these issues, is this a sign to traditionally minded Catholics that have been looking for it that the Church is still on the right track under Pope Francis? Is that what it was designed to do?
Well, I think it's designed to teach Catholic truth, and it did so in a clear way on those matters. But I would, the criteria that are applied, particularly as regards sex change and gender theory, is that since we are created male and female by God, we have to accept that reality, and dignity consists in affirming that reality. Well, if that's the case, no future church document should ever use the term LGBT, because LGBT, the T, means transsexual, and that's certainly, we don't believe that exists, because as the document says, you can't change from being a male to a female. And then likewise, homosexual activity is a misuse of the male or female sexual faculty, and therefore that's a rejection of God's order. So this document in and of itself supplies a confutation of some of the things that the Vatican has said earlier this, the last six months about transgender godparents and homosexual couples. Speaking plainly, you cannot be a couple of two men. You can only be a couple of a man and a woman. So I'm happy about that. I hope that comes up in further discussion.
Well, Bob, Father is touching on a point here that there seems to be dissonance here from the Vatican, where you have the documents coming out and repeating the old line, if you will, saying what the Church has always taught. But in practice, Father alluded to some of the things we've heard in recent days. You've got the press conferences and the shifts in addressing a transgender woman, a man, biological man, as a sister. The Pope has written and addressed individuals that way. But yet the doctrine, this document, condemns and says you can't do this. Well, which is it? What's going on here?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when we talk about confusion in the Vatican, a lot of people look at the words that are said, even in Fiducia Supplicans, which was the document that allowed blessings of so-called couples in irregular unions. Even there, the proper understanding of what a sexual relationship is stated and said it can't be anything else. But then we go on and we kind of set up this kind of parallel way of acting. This is what I was talking about before, about we seem to act differently than we're speaking. When the Holy Father has a luncheon for trans people in Rome, or when he invites in Father James Martin or New Age Ministries and says, you know, you people are practicing the style of God, well, he's just condemned gender theory. And we know that these two, this individual and this organization, have been absolutely disputing the church's teaching and pursuing things that are very similar to gender theory. So, you know, when I was a young man, the best advice I got from the adults around me was, don't look at what people say, look at what they do. And insofar as we feel confusion, it's perhaps a little bit less in the words than in the behavior that we see here in Rome.
Fernandez was asked if he believes it is time for the church to change its teaching that homosexual acts are, quote, intrinsically disordered. At the press conference, he said the following. On the expression intrinsically disordered, it's true that it's a very strong expression and that you have to explain a lot, right? Maybe we could find an expression that is even clearer to understand what we want to say. Father Jerry, Fernandez goes on to say that there's no comparison between the beauty of a male-female relationship and that homosexual acts cannot reflect natural intimacy and fertility. So why the call to change the language then?
Well, I would say to the cardinal, it's not simply a strong statement, it's a true statement, and that's what counts. True statements are what the gospel calls us to proclaim to the world. To say that we need something that's clearer and less confusing, no, the reason why people object to this who promote the homosexual agenda is because it's all too clear. Everybody knows what disordered means. It means out of order, not working properly, not following the path that it's supposed to follow. So this is, remember the first Synod on the Family when we had the interim document which talked about positive aspects of homosexual relationships? This is, ever since then, we've been hearing that people are saying the catechism has to be changed. You can't say that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. Those are proponents of that ideology. No, we can say it. We must say it because it's the truth. So Cardinal Fernandez, I hope he's not going to push this, because if you want to say on the one hand, we have to respect God's order as regards sex change and gender theory, well, don't we have to respect God's order as regards male-female as the only expression of sexual relations in a marriage? That's a truth that cannot be done away with.
I want to move on to a couple of other stories that we have to touch on. Firstly, we found out this week that five new allegations of alleged abuse perpetuated by that disgraced Jesuit priest, the artist Marco Rupnik, have been presented to the doctrinal office in Rome. And we have long reported Rupnik is accused of grave sexual and spiritual and psychological abuse of at least 20 women religious, but still seems to be enjoying some level of protection at the Vatican. Bob, the Pope did lift the statute of limitations on cases against Rupnik, but the hits just seem to keep coming. What do you make of these new findings, and will this finally cause the Vatican to act decisively against this alleged perpetrator?
Look, I, like almost all Catholics, have known a few priests who've been accused of something abusive. And as we know in the United States, because we're very sensitive about the abuse by clergy, they are almost always immediately removed. And they may not be convicted, but they're almost immediately removed because of liabilities, legal, and, you know, the desire to have zero tolerance for abuse. This is a man who quite clearly, I mean, with these five, it may even be over two dozen women, and there are actually some men as well. And yet no one seemed to want to touch him because he was a celebrity artist. Now, the Pope did lift the statute of limitations back in October, but we're well into April right now. And unlike what happens in almost every diocese in the United States, he's still functioning with faculties that he has back in Slovenia, here in Rome. So, you know, we talk a good game. This is, I'm coming back to this language versus action again, but we talk a good game on abuse and zero tolerance. We don't really act on it as well.
Yeah. Father, I mean, you've got priests who are found, you know, celebrating that horrible Tridentine rite, and they throw them to the curb instantly. All the faculties are taken away. This guy, you've got a parade of people coming forward over many, many years begging for justice here, and he continues to have his faculties. Now, some have speculated that the Pope's removal this week of the Vicar of Rome, this man, Cardinal Angelo De Donatis, was tied to the Rupnik affair. The cardinal, back in 2022, issued a letter, and in that letter he said the decision to keep Rupnik as a rector of a church came from the Pope and not from him. Any truth that this may have been a factor in the removal of the cardinal? I mean, the Pope did announce a reform of the Diocese of Rome, so I get that this may be have been a part of that.
I can't answer that question. I don't know, but you can certainly say not only that the cardinal, but an auxiliary bishop of the Diocese of Rome, Bishop Livinori, who is a Jesuit himself, he was removed as auxiliary bishop of Rome and appointed to a essentially desk job in the congregate or the dicastery for religious as an assessor, you know, an advisor, so to speak. And it was Livinori who investigated the community that was founded by Father Rupnik and found grave disorder, and he was very strong that Rupnik should be punished. And let me just throw a couple of things in here on the Rupnik. Number one, Rupnik has already been convicted of having abused the sacrament of penance, absolving someone that he sexually abused. And then secondly, he was investigated by the Jesuits and found to have committed serious crimes. The investigations have been done. If they wanted to, Rupnik's trial could happen tomorrow. There are sufficient charges. And he could be drummed out of the priesthood, as everybody, I believe, thinks he should, based on the public evidence. So keeping him as a functioning priest, I mean, he can sit in a confession box still. This is absurd. This should not be happening.
Okay. I've got to get this story in. We only have about 4 minutes. Pope Francis has given himself a new title this week, the title of Patriarch of the West in the latest edition of the Pontifical Yearbook. Father, what does that title really signify? And what do you think he's trying to indicate by readopting it? Wasn't it dropped as a papal title by Pope Benedict XVI?
It was dropped by Pope Benedict. It's a title that goes back, you know, to antiquity. You have the Patriarch of the East, Patriarch of the West. You know, when you're the Supreme Pontiff, other titles are ancillary. They indicate a specific jurisdictional sphere of action, but it doesn't really make much difference. Now, why was it brought back? That's a good question. I don't know, but certainly it surprised me that it was brought back.
Yeah, Bob, your thoughts. And might this be related to the Pope's desire to be known simply as Bishop Emeritus of Rome, the Diocese of Rome, should he choose to resign the papacy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we really need an explanation from the Vatican about why this happened. I mean, people noticed it, and it was surprising. I tend to side with Pope Benedict, who retired that title. And the reason he said that he did it is it didn't make a lot of sense, because it made sense when you had the Eastern and Western Roman Empire and basically Eastern and Western Europe, and it was divided between, you know, Latin Catholics in the West and Orthodox, Greek Orthodox in the East. Well, the Catholic Church right now is a global entity. So the Catholic Church exists in Australia and China and Russia and Africa. So to call the Pope the Patriarch of the West as a kind of another title, I don't know if this is an attempt to make himself look like he's one with the, you know, the Patriarch of Moscow or the Universal Patriarch of Constantinople, and then therefore he's more of an equal with the people in Orthodoxy and Eastern Christianity. We need the Vatican to explain what this is and why it is that the Pope thought it was a good thing to bring it back when a great theological mind like Benedict just decided it didn't make any sense.
Gentlemen, we will leave it there. We are just out of time. Robert Royal, Father Gerald Murray, thank you both for being here. And you can find more commentary from both members of the posse at thecatholicthing.org. In February, I reported that McKenna Mack Sinise, the beloved son of actor and philanthropist Gary Sinise, died on January 5th at the age of 33 after battling a rare form of cancer. Mack was a musician, a composer. For a time, he played drums in his father's Lieutenant Dan band. I sat down with Gary Sinise and Mac's dear friend and musical collaborator, Oliver Schnee, in Nashville recently to talk about Mac's struggle and his final wish to create an album of his unfinished musical compositions. It is a story of healing, hope, and faith with a lesson for all of us. Mac Sinise was diagnosed with cancer in 2018, sparking a struggle and a final work he could not foresee at the time. Here's my interview with Gary Sinise. Tell me what Mac was like before the cancer diagnosis.
He was just, Mac is a, he's just full spirit, kind of a little bit shy, but a very, very smart, deep thinker. Really was the kind of person who you couldn't just sort of tell him something and have him sort of accept it and just kind of go on. He would want to know, well, why do you think that?
You were telling me the other day about 2017 when Mac has a reversion to faith, to his Catholic faith.
So he went to USC. He graduated from USC, Thornton School of Music. Mm-hmm. Studied songwriting, composition. He was a drummer, yeah. Really, really great drummer. Then he graduates and he goes off and starts the music thing. And he was in the music thing. And, at one point he just was not as happy as he wanted to be. He just found himself kind of at a loss. So he came home for a while to kind of regroup. And one of the things that we introduced him to a friend of ours who had been kind of a counselor or therapist, Catholic, really good Catholic sort of thinker. And a lot of things opened up for Mac at that point. He really started finding out that he was a very faithful spiritual guy. And I think he was reinvestigating a lot of that and really finding out that that was a big, important part of his life. I mean, it was Bishop Robert Barron who confirmed Mac into the church in 2017. This was probably 14 months before he was diagnosed with cancer. And the church and his faith and, what he was seeking and what he was discovering and how he was analyzing and the people he was meeting, became such a big part of his life.
Tell me about this cancer, Gary. How did it first manifest and what was it? It's a very rare strain of cancer.
Yeah. So Mac was having a lot of trouble with pain in his tailbone for not just a short period of time, over a number of years.
Wow.
And we thought, he had seen a doctor. The doctor said, well, it's probably a bruise. You got a bruise on your tailbone. At one point, he was on a tour with a band over in Europe. And they went for a bike ride, and he jammed on the brakes a little too hard. And his tailbone went into the seat, and he had just a lot of pain. So he thought maybe this pain that he's having later on was related to something he did with the bike.
Right.
But it just got worse and worse. I mean, he was just having trouble sleeping. Finally, Moira, my wife, had some spine surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sent Mac to her spine surgeon. Mm. And he put him in the CT scanner and called me up and said, there's a tumor. And he showed us this orange-sized tumor that was on Mac's tailbone. And he said, I think this is something called a chordoma. It's a very, very rare cancer. Maybe 300 people per year in the U.S. Mm. are diagnosed with this cancer. Quite often, they can take out the initial tumor, and they can cure it. It's gone. They get everything, and it's gone. But about 30% of those 300 cases, the cancer comes back, and that's what happened with Mac.
How did it change him? Did it change him?
Surgery was scheduled for September of 2018, and we went to UCLA in Santa Monica, and the tumor was removed, and because of the way the tumor was on the sacrum and the nerves and everything like that, certain things were you know, they had, and in order to get it, they had to cut certain nerves, and so that altered his lifestyle a bit. But he was still able to walk. You know, he went to rehab. But, you know, unfortunately, about 8 months later, we found out that the cancer came back. Oof. And it was starting to spread.
When did Mac lose the use of one side of his body? I mean, he could no longer drum his great love in music.
Yeah, I think in 2019, you know, he was now we had to deal with chemo and radiation. He had to start to step away from the foundation. Yeah. He was still able to walk, mm-hmm. but he was just in the battle. And then we found out right around Christmas time in 2019 that there was more tumor on his neck. So he's going to have to go in early 2020 and get another surgery on his neck to remove tumor here. He was in there for 2 months. This is 2020. Remember, 2 months. But then he had to have another spine surgery. Mm. So we had to go back in June, and he was in the hospital then for 4 months. Mm. So 6 out of the first 8 months of 2020, he was in the hospital, and it was that one that the nature of removing the tumor from the spine did a lot of damage to his right side. Mm. And he really couldn't move his right leg very well. And he couldn't use the fingers on his right hand.
So, Gary, after all of these surgeries and the chemo and the radiation, I can see why he sort of gave up on music for a time.
Yeah, well, yeah, 2020 was a big year because he was in the hospital most of the year. By the time he got home, he was now in a wheelchair. He lost all feeling from here down. So he couldn't walk anymore. So music was, you know, he wasn't even thinking about music at that point. He's fighting cancer. He's doing multiple different drugs that they're trying on him to fight the cancer. There are no drugs for chordoma.
Mac's friend, Oliver Schnee, a fellow musician, had lost touch with his college buddy.
I kind of took a step back and wanted to give him some space, and I would still send messages of love and support from afar, whether it be a voicemail or a text or an email.
But he wasn't responding.
Wouldn't get a response. And finally, earlier last year, I found some old photos of Mac and I at Disneyland from, I don't know, we were 19, 20 years old, just children. And I thought, you know, what the heck, I'm going to send it to him. And even if he doesn't respond, maybe he'll see them and it'll give him a moment of joy, of nostalgia. And to my surprise, he responded right away. And I went, oh my God, hey, you're alive. You want to come to my studio? You want to meet halfway? Because we were living on opposite sides of the town. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I guess you don't know, but you know, I'm sadly paralyzed right now. And I went, oh, I did not know that. I'll come to you. Wow. And so I drove to his house. Oh man, my heart broke. When I saw Mac, nothing could have really prepared me for just how heavy it was. Especially knowing that he was a drummer and now being paralyzed, he couldn't even play his instrument as a form of catharsis. Mm. And so that really hit hard. But what I did notice was that his attitude and his spirit was still incredibly upbeat. Oh. And it was very admirable and inspiring to witness. And while we were there, I asked him, Mac, you know, obviously you can't play drums anymore. But what is your relationship with music like these days? Are you listening to music? Is it too painful? And he lit up.
I told him kind of that I was trying to write music and stuff again. And I had stopped, you know, quite a bit, you know, just been focusing on trying to get my health back into shape and just to fight this battle of cancer. And in the process, you know, writing music has been a huge therapy for me.
And he said, I found this old piece of music that I had started to write back when I was in college. I never finished it, but I really want to, and I want to do it with a full orchestra. I want to do it before I reach my sunset. And I said, oh, wow, okay. Can I hear it? And so he sent it to me, and I called back the next day, and I said, Mac, this is really good.
And is that how he put it to you? You mentioned a moment ago, he said, we want to get this done before my sunset.
the way he said was even a little more blunt. I asked him, so what sort of timeline are you on? And he said, well, preferably sooner than later. I'd like to have it done before I go. And I went, oh, wow. Oh, boy. Well, that's something I never needed to hear. I mean, but totally got the message across.
The urgency of this.
Yeah, it's the true definition of deadline, you know? Mm. And it was just like, okay, let's get this done.
Hi, everyone.
And then he starts finishing works he had begun. Is he writing new things? What's happening?
I'm discovering a lot of things on his phone and on his iPad now that I didn't know he was dabbling with. So we'd go to bed and he was up and we had in-home nursing care that was there with him. But he'd be in there doing all kinds of things. He's listening to podcasts, you know, reading his Bible, or writing music, we discovered. So he was playing with some different ideas.
How was he writing these pieces?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was curious how he was doing that too. And then one of the days I was at his house, he's in his hospital bed, and he's got a little stylus Velcroed to his hand with an iPad, and he's tapping in individual notes one by one. And I mean, it's just the beauty of what technology can do, but also the beauty of his patience, because that takes a lot longer than being able to just do-do-do-do-do,
right.
Or even with a pencil and paper, you know.
Right, right.
Because his mind might be going 100 miles an hour, but his body's not able to do that. And so he was always very excited, like, hey, check this out. I wrote 8 bars of this new melody. Do you think this works? Huh. And I'd listen to it, and I'd say, yeah. It was amazing watching him work and write, because it was like unlike any other project I'd been a part of.
Yeah, exactly.
He's still doing chemo. He's still having nausea and side effects from the chemo. He's still having issues with the cancer. But all the while, he's working on this piece with Oliver. And, you know, he said to me at a certain point, Dad, we're gonna record this. Let's, what do you think? And should I pay for it? And I said, well, you have the money. Yeah, you should definitely do it. And so he really started gearing up for the fact that he could finance his own recording. This is Arctic Circle.
Arctic Circle.
Oliver started in on the arrangement, and then by July, they were in the studio.
Think you're in the Arctic. It's white. The wind is whistling by, and as soon as you speak, your word, the wind takes it and it's gone. Then let's give it a shot. Have some fun, guys.
It was this wild mixture of his body failing, but mentally, creatively, spiritually, he's still going. And there's still a lot of music inside him that wants to come out and that needs to come out.
Well, you watch it, and he is, I mean, he is beaming in the video. It's like he's, I mean, Oliver said it was like the old Mac was back.
Yeah. It was incredible to watch Oliver back there, and Mac's like going through the score, and he says, in bar 36, can you go and try this thing, make it shorter, and blah, blah. And he's working. He's sitting there working. He's not just, he's working with Oliver to make the piece come to life the way they had it envisioned. It was beautiful, and Raymond, I hadn't heard any of it.
Really?
Until that day. Penguin Dance is a little different. He wrote that after they recorded Arctic Circles. He wrote Penguin Dance. He's sitting there watching penguins in nature shows on his television and just was inspired to write that song. He was working on all kinds of things, you know, that we didn't know, and he was thinking all kinds of things.
I did notice, as we got started, that there was an uptick in his energy level and his attitude. Everyone from his housekeepers to his parents to his sisters to his brother-in-law, they all said the same thing, which is, since he started working on this project, he is back to being Mac. He's smiling again. He's waking up, looking forward to the day ahead of him.
He rediscovered his purpose.
Yeah. And then he calls and he goes, "Hey, man, I need to finish this." And I went, "What do you mean?" He's like, "This project is keeping me going. It's keeping me alive. I'm rediscovering my purpose. So can we do a whole album?" I said, "Let's do it, man."
That's when they made the decision to make an album of music. Aww. And not just a couple of pieces, mm-hmm. but make a whole record of pieces, 10 different pieces. And he wanted that day in the studio with my band. And so the types of music he picked were things that he could play harmonica on.
He very typical Mac, very gentle soul, very humble, very soft-spoken, very politely asked, "What do you think about adding strings to this?" And it was an old tune called Shenandoah. Yeah. And I said, "Well, that's a great idea. Also, I think it's vital and very important that you are performing on this because you're not able to perform on Arctic Circles." And he said, "That's a great idea. I want that to be a gift to my family, you know, when the day comes." And once again, him always thinking of others and thinking of giving back to his family. Breathing, he could only really play up to 15, 20 seconds at a time. And his timing was still brilliant, being a drummer. That internal clock never left him. And I'm so glad that his mom recommended that he pick up the harmonica because it was the one way that he could find an outlet for this music that was inside. And Mac, the day before, again, very gentle soul, calls me and goes, "I want the experience of recording with my dad one last time." And I went, "Say no more. We'll set you up in a booth. We'll give you direct eye line to Gary."
And suddenly he's playing full takes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the most powerful and incredible moments through the whole last 12 months was being at Blackbird Studio D. Something kicked into high gear, adrenaline or what, but he was able to play the song from top to bottom when he couldn't play 15 seconds a few weeks ago. He was able to play the whole song top to bottom.
So we play Red River Valley on his record with Mac playing harmonica. My singer, Jeff Fazane, sings the lyrics. I'm playing bass. That was a great moment.
Just seeing him in the studio with his dad playing like they used to, you know, and it was really beautiful and really inspiring.
You used a phrase to describe Mac throughout this whole recording period. What was the line you mentioned to me?
Spitting out the venom. I don't know where I heard it a few years ago, but it always stuck with me, and it basically meaning whatever venom inside, whether it's emotional turmoil, physical failure, mental health, whatever it is, spitting that venom out and choosing to create something beautiful with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mac did that in spades, and as someone who is obsessed with finding meaning in life, this was so meaningful to not only witness, but to be a part of.
What's the lesson here? What's the lesson here for other people who are suffering the same way?
Mac wanted to keep living, you know, in spite of the damage that was being done to him by the disease. And every moment that he had that he was feeling good, he was taking advantage of it. That's what we talked about a lot, you know, because sometimes Mac would start to think down the road a little bit too much. And I said, Mac, it's, you know, well, what if I don't feel good, you know, when we want to go over here or when we want to do something? And I said, you know, we discussed together, you know, the fact that he should not spend time thinking about that. You know, not spend time thinking about what might be down the road or what. And he got really good at that, at thinking for today and, you know, living for today. And those days in the studio, you can see, you know, he was alive in the studio when you see those videos, and he was enjoying those moments. His faith really sustained him a lot. And if you look in his Bible and you look in some of the books that he was reading, he was constantly underlining things that really jumped out to him and meant something to him. And when I sit and read some of the things, you know, it's like Mac just telling me stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like messages, you know.
What do you think he's telling you now?
Keep going, Dad. Keep going. Stop crying.
No, you're doing it. It's an amazing tribute to him, and it's his spirit that you hear in those recordings. And when you sent me that first clip, I think it was Arctic Circles that you first sent.
Yeah, yeah, and Shenandoah.
I remember it was at the end of the year, and I'm reporting all the normal crap and trash we have to report day in and day out, political and otherwise. And I thought, this is the end of the year. You got to give people some hope. And when I heard this music and the story, I said, we got to tell this somehow. And I know there was some hesitation, and we went back and forth, and you agreed to come on when I was hosting at Fox. This is the moment when you and Mac and the family first heard his composition, which took many years to write, come to life. I'm so glad Mac saw that. What was his reaction to your appearance and sharing his music with people really for the first time?
What I feel now is that, you know, and especially after seeing how Mac lit up when I did go on your show, and you featured his music, and I was in the satellite truck in our driveway doing the interview live with you while he was in the house watching it, and then coming in and seeing the look on his face and how proud he was and smiling. And the next day I had to take him to the hospital.
What happened?
And, you know, he was having trouble breathing. And you sent me the clip of the interview, and he was in the hospital showing that clip to, while he was still able to, showing the clip to the nurses and the doctors, and then they would go to his YouTube channel and look at the music, come back in crying and tell him how great it was, and then he'd light up and smile. He was at peace at the end, and he was happy at the end with what he'd accomplished, and he felt very, I think he felt, you know, he felt good.
He had completed his mission, this great work that it was inside of him that he didn't get out before. I mean, when I listen to it, I hear that. I hear hope, hard-won hope at times, but hope.
Let's take it back to like a year ago. There were certain parts of this whole journey that I didn't think I was going to survive through. And maybe if I just get in touch with a friend of mine and you know, suggest like maybe we could, you know, do an album and you know, that was just way far off my radar, you know, didn't think that was possible at all. And, you know, here I am, you know, two months later or whatever it is, and the ideas that were in my head are now realized into reality. So it just goes to show me that, like, I have to, you know, just keep moving forward.
With Mac, you know, I think he, at a certain point, he accepted what was happening. In fact, I know because since then, as I said, I went into his phone and I went into his iPad and I found things that he wrote, you know, like years ago when he thought maybe he wasn't going to make it or wasn't going to be around very long. And he wrote things in preparation for that time where we would miss him and where he wanted us to know certain things that we should not be concerned about, you know, and that he had a good life and that he was accepting of it. And then toward the end where he just said, I'm going to live as much as I possibly can for whatever time I have, and we don't know how long that's going to be. And what do I want to do? I want to complete some things that I never completed before. And he did that. And that's a really positive, inspiring story of perseverance through real obstacle and real challenge. No matter what, don't give up. Fight on. You know, live to the fullest as long as you can.
Gary, I have to tell you, I mean, Moira had her own health battles while Mac is having his. I mean, how did you balance that, deal with it? I mean, these are two of the people you love most in the world, and they're both, these are grave health challenges they're both facing at the same time.
Yeah, we found out Moira had cancer 2 months before we found out Mac had cancer. And she had multiple spine surgeries and hip surgeries. And then along comes Mac, and he's got a big tumor, and he's got a cancer, and we've got to fight.
It has to try you, though. Try your faith.
There were times where I just kind of fell down on the stairs, and there was some very challenging moments where I think most challenging was kind of not knowing what to do. You know, I'm running out of
options.
I'm running out of ideas to help both of them, you know. Yet you get over that pretty quickly, and then you make the next phone call, you know, you call the next doctor or try to figure out, you know, the next step. And I didn't want Mac thinking about his cancer problem all the time and, you know, what doctors to call and, you know, who to talk to about this and that. I tried to take that as much as I could.
Well, that's real faith, the act, to just keep going.
Yeah.
That's real faith.
You know, and I've learned a lot, Raymond, over the years from a lot of very, very broken families, you know, that we deal with at the Gary Sinise Foundation. We're dealing with a lot of, you know, difficult things, you know, wounded folks and, you know, broken families that have lost loved ones, you know, in military service. And I've been around that a lot. I've been in the hospitals a lot. You know, I felt like when a lot of this stuff started happening, I was sort of somewhat prepared for it because of the amount of time I'd spent with other families that were going through the same thing and watching them kind of power through and
punch
just
back and continue on.
Do what they got to do. So that gave me a lot of strength and courage and, you know, inspiration to just face it. And I, you know, prayed on it. And, you know, we have a strong family. Our daughters are amazing. Their husbands are amazing. My wife is amazing, the way she's dealt with one physical problem after another. And our faith has been good to us and strong for us.
Animated by that faith, the Sinise family are honoring Mac with the release of his first album.
And he calls it Resurrection and Revival because everything, all his film composition stuff, with the exception of Penguin Dance, is kind of, he's kind of bringing it back to life. Mm-hmm. And then he's got older songs that are on there, like Red River Valley and Amazing Grace and stuff that he wants to sort of revive and bring back to new life. And he calls it Resurrection and Revival. He designed the album cover. He designed the back. You know, he wanted to print. He said, "Dad, what do you think if I just print up 100 vinyls to get, so we can give them to people? And if we sell any, we can the proceeds can go to the Gary Sinise Foundation." I said, "Oh, that's a great idea, Mac. Do it."
Mac, who was the one who was unhealthy, is the one giving all of us the good medicine, you know. And still to this day, we find little gems of pieces of music that he, you know, started to write and then put on the shelf and then started to write something else.
Kind of angled looking this way so we can get a shot of you playing and the players are behind, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, and Oliver did a tremendous job. They were a great team, and, you know, it was God at work there that just out of the blue, you know, they reconnect after all those years, and then they go to work together and create this music. It was beautiful.
Spectacular. Gary Sinise, you're a good dad.
Thank you.
Resurrection and Revival, Music by Mac Sinise, is available in a special vinyl-only edition from the Gary Sinise Foundation website. Visit store.garysinisefoundation.com to place an order. Per Mac Sinise's wishes, all proceeds from the vinyl edition of Resurrection and Revival will go to benefit the work of the Gary Sinise Foundation. We will let you know when it becomes available on CD or on the streaming platforms. You can also contribute to Teen Mac, his fundraising campaign, at the Cordoma Foundation. Visit impact.cordomafoundation.org/Team Mac. What a great soul. May Mac Sinise rest in peace and keep our friends, the Sinise family, in your prayers. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. We have a special commemoration of the 101st birthday of our beloved founders, Mother Mary Angelica. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.